Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute Daily Podcast, as we curry our way through the 2001 miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Shane Canto of The Wasteland Reviewer. Welcome back to the show, Shane.
Thank you so much for having me on again, Rob. Round two for this episode of Band of Brothers, so...
I hope you're not too fatigued from carrying around all that equipment, which is probably double your weight, double my weight, double everyone's weight, you know, especially double.
Sure. I'm certainly sure it's not double my weight, but because of my weight, this would be a very strenuous activity. Not gonna lie.
Me too. That's fine. But it's a good thing that Joe Toy is able to carry all of his equipment. That's what's important.
For sure.
Exactly. So, episode 13 begins with Malarkey having a question and ends with Meehan giving last-minute instructions. So, we ended things yesterday with basically learning about the whole thing about Garnier's brother and Martin and Lip debating what they should do at this point. You know, do you tell him or do you not tell him? And right as the 5 minute segment was ending, we switched and we saw something. You can't really even tell what it is because it's on for just a fraction of a second. We see someone very confused with some piece of equipment that they're putting on, and the beginning of this segment reveals who it is. It's Malarkey. And we see Malarkey trying to put something on that he wasn't able to figure it out. And again, I like the way that they do this. They, you know, they're little by little giving us information as to what these men really have to go through, and it's great. Because also, you know, Malarkey, who's played by Scott Grimes, is a pretty small guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he's just looking at, like, you know, a knapsack and isn't really sure what he's supposed to be doing with it. And he goes, why are they springing these things on us now? And then George Luz comes over to me, played by Rick Gomez, says, just an extra 80 pounds chopped your leg. Then he looks around and goes, does anybody have any idea how the hell this thing works? And then they get a... someone passes out flyers, and they go, Colonel Sink. And then Luz picks it up and goes, and he does it in the voice of Colonel Sink, and he goes, soldiers of the regiment, tonight is the night of night. Today, as you read this, you are en route to the great adventure from which you have trained for over 2 years. And then Garnier's on the ground, and he goes, so that's why they gave us ice cream.
Like, this is one of the benefits of a mini series is getting little moments like this. That, like, if this were a film, you wouldn't be able to squeeze in all of these little character moments, but it's a fun character moment, and it also continues to reinforce all of these things that they have to carry and to process and deal with and figure out. And it's always fun having moments like that where you have people talking about or like doing impersonations of their bosses or their superiors in situations, because it's like they spend all this time with them, they hear from them all the time, and it's that shared experience. It's like everybody else knows exactly who this person is, so I appreciated those little moments.
Right. I mean, one of the
to start off this segment.
One of the ironic things is you know, you said that in a miniseries you have the chance to tell more of these little anecdotes between the characters, stuff like that. But because of the vast number of men that were part of Easy Company, a lot of the characters are also amalgams of other characters that even within 10 hours, they weren't able to depict everybody with the whole thing.
Absolutely.
So it's nice the way that they show that also. You know, they give us a lot, even though they don't, even though they aren't able to give us everything. So yeah, I like that. Now, do you have any ideas that, you know, what are these bags? You have any idea?
I don't think I was particularly I wasn't quite sure exactly what they were doing there.
Okay, so this is actually something that the reason that they're showing us that Malarkey and Luz are like confused about this whole thing, because this is something that they just were given that day. Okay, the British Airborne had come up with the idea of what's known as leg bags, which are bags that contain extra ammunition, radios, machine gun
Okay.
tripods, medical gear, high explosives, other equipment, and basically they would attach them to their legs with a quick release mechanism that was fashioned to the parachute harness by a 20-foot rope that was coiled. And then when the chute opened up, so the trooper was supposed to hold the weight of the leg bag, pull its release to separate it from his leg, and let it down to the end of the rope. And then it would hit the ground before they would, so that in theory, the trooper would land on top of the bundle and not have to waste any time looking for all their equipment. The idea was a great idea, but none of the American airborne men had ever done something like this before. And what they ended up doing was is they just stuffed as much stuff that they can get into there. They put in mines, ammunition, Tommy guns, anything. And part of the problem was is that it made these leg bags really, really heavy, which we'll see in part two, that Winters loses his leg bag. He doesn't even have a weapon because of that. So again, it's a nice little thing for them to show us without us really having to understand what it is. And they also show us that even veterans like Malarkey and Luz, have no idea what this whole thing is and how it actually works. So
Well, and it's so
I like this little
interesting.
moment.
Well, yeah, and no wonder they made a joke about an extra 80 pounds on your leg. Trying to shove all that munitions and all those things in there. But it's also a very human moment because I feel like a lot of people have been on a job before where it's just like, here's this thing, use this last minute. And then you're trying to figure out like, what am I supposed to do with this?
That's right.
And those are all those little hu very human moments that allows the audience to connect with them because has everybody been in the military? No. But has everybody been in a job or done something where it's like you had instructions, or maybe sometimes at the last minute, just like, hey, here's this new thing. Figure it out. And it's just like, well, I hope to figure this out. Obviously, their situation is much more dangerous than most people are going to be trying to figure something out like that. But it's a really good character moment. But then to your point, reinforcing where the series goes, it becomes significant. And how that comes back, so.
Correct. Right. And again, even if you haven't read the book, you still get the idea that they have these, there are these special things that they need to deal with for for when they're getting ready for this jump. So, it's a nice little moment with the whole thing.
Absolutely.
We already know that Luz knows how to do the impressions because he, did the impressions. I think it was. Was I think it was last yeah it was last week's episodes where he was doing impressions of Major Horton in order to slightly confuse Sobel. So it works really well.
Was a great moment.
Yeah,
That one really stuck out for sure.
that's right. And and as Luz is reading, you can see in the background just these men are all just lying on the tarmac, just waiting to get the orders. To move out. And the camera work also when Luz is reading it is also great because it zooms in on him as he's doing that with that whole thing. And but these guys are not too thrilled about the whole thing. And then we get a long shot of all the men, a whole bunch of guys with their faces painted black and getting ready to for the jump and stuff like that. And we hear Mian's voice and he screams, "Easy Company, listen up. Channel Coast is socked in rain and fog. No jump tonight." And everyone gives off like a big sigh and he goes, "The invasion has been postponed. We're on a 24-hour stand down." And these guys are not too happy about it, but they don't really have much of a choice, obviously. It's the idea that you're anticipating and you're waiting and waiting and waiting, and then suddenly, nope, not going to be this time. You got to wait another 24 hours. I mean, that's also a lot of time for these guys to have to wait.
Well, yeah, and especially when you have this anticipation of something that you really have to make sure that you're in the right headspace going into such a dangerous situation. And then you're just like, just kidding, 24 more hours. And then you have a whole other day to be sitting around thinking about this. And that is such a challenging moment. And it was interesting because, like, I knew there were these delays and stuff like that from, learning about World War II, reading about World War II and watching other films about D-Day.
Well, you see
So
in the first
I
5 minutes of this part when
yeah.
before they jump to all of the training, we get to see that they're informed that it's postponed. But at this point, you've now sit and watched 50 minutes since then, or 55 minutes since then, you've forgotten about that fact. It doesn't matter that and they have to bring you back into the present that, okay, now we've caught up with where we were.
Well, and it's one of those moments where it's like reinforcing when you're watching something with historical context that you have, and it's just like, oh, well, this is going to be coming up for them. And you see them getting ready and waiting and waiting. It's just like, nope, gotta wait a little bit longer.
That's right.
So.
Yeah. So I'm sure that many of these guys, despite being disappointed, they're also relieved for the same point. Because they know where they're going is not going to be something very simple. And then the shot changes, and we're back in the movie theater that we saw at the beginning of this part also. And we once again see the movie being shown, Lucky Man, with Cary Grant. And on screen he says, "Well, this is quite a surprise. Not particularly. It so happens I rather expected it. Well, I can't see how you people can pass up $80,000 for the cause." "For what cause? If you're so interested in serving a cause, why don't you join the army?" "Next, please. 4M. You look 1A to me. Hey, you don't look so bad yourself." So again, it's very funny that they're reshowing all of the exact same lines that we saw at the beginning of this part. But now they're letting us see it from Garnier's perspective, because Garnier's the one who's sitting there as this movie is playing out. Again, the exact same lines that we were talking about at the beginning of this part. And he sees that there's something in his pocket, and he goes to pull it out, and he looks a little confused. He's taking a cigarette from his pack of cigarettes, and something's off. It just doesn't look right to him. And he's scrutinizing it, trying to figure it out what's going on. And he's like, it must be this like a different brand than what he usually uses. I think that must be the explanation as to what he's looking at. And then, he's got a very, very confused look on his face. And the actor who plays Garnier, Frank John Hughes, he does Frank John Hughes does an amazing job here, letting us see the confusion in Garnier's face as they're watching this movie. He doesn't understand how it's possible that it's not his cigarettes and that there's something else in the pocket. And he fishes into the pocket to try and figure out what it is, and he pulls out a letter. And he says, okay, he's gonna start reading the letter to see what's going on. See who's this letter from? And then we can actually read part of the letter. It was sent to April 18th, 1944, from Springfield, Ohio. And it says, "My dearest Johnny, how I wish you were here to see the springtime. It looks like the snow is finally gone for good. There's more green in our garden every time I look outside. If only your letters get here a little faster, a little less information from them. After all day at work, my greatest thrill is finding a letter from you waiting for me. But it's never enough. I want to see what you see, and I would know that you're all right." The letter continues. It's a little harder to read what it's saying. It says, "I also got a letter yesterday from something about Bill Garnier's older brother who was killed in Monte Cassino." So I got to say that the detail here is amazing, that we actually can see the letter that's you know, that he's reading. And obviously, you know, he shouldn't be looking at his letters. But Garnier continues, starts to read it, and we hear him say, "Dear Johnny." And then on screen, you know, we still hear Lorraine Day and Cary Grant talking while he's looking at this letter. He says, "Well, should you be giving blood?" He goes, "I woke up." And then Garnier says to himself, "I got the wrong goddamn jacket." And the guy, he's telling it to the guy next to him. And the guy goes, "Shh." You know, I hate when people talk to me during movies anyway. I was able to appreciate that little shh that he was given. And then on screen, we continue hearing, "I was struck by lightning. Nobody dancing. It doesn't matter." And then Garnier continues reading, and we hear him say, "Your pal, Bill Garnier's brother." And then it trails off a little bit. And then once again, we hear Cary Grant say, "Remember this. Remember this. I didn't lie to you. You were right, and I was wrong." And then we hear the projector whirring as it's going along. So again, I think it's very effective the way that they're telling this part of the story. I mean, I don't know if Garnier really read it in the middle of the movie or not. I don't think it makes a difference. But it's very effective, especially given Frank John Hughes's performance here.
It makes the scene so much more interesting, because this could have just been him like sitting and finding the letter and him just reading it aloud. But you have the movie going on in the background, the things that Cary Grant saying, and how they layer into the situation. And it's interesting him, you know, being like, "This doesn't seem right. It's like, this isn't my jacket," and starting to read this letter and everything. And it just adds layers to the scene as a scene. And, you know, the little moment too of like, yes, one of my biggest pet peeves is when people just start talking in the movie theater. It's just like, think like, we're here to watch a movie. And obviously all of them are just trying to enjoy this movie with impending doom waiting for them. It's just like, come on. And I do agree, he did a fantastic job of selling this scene, Frank John Hughes, because he had to maneuver a lot in a complicated situation of, you're in a movie, you're trying to be quiet, but you're confused, you're trying to piece things together, you have this realization, and it's just like, what's going on here? And I thought it was a very interesting way that the writers staged this scene and how this all played out.
Yeah, totally agree. And I also like the fact that we already know this information. You know, Martin and Lip were talking about it already. So, you know, the fact that you know, you don't need to be able to pause it to be able to read the letter like we just did. You know, the idea is you see he's reading a letter. You, even if you look at it and you get a quick glance and you see it says "Dear Johnny," and then you see the name of Bill Garnier, and that's it. You already know that this is what they're telling us. And it's very effective also the way that it just fades to black right after we see this realization on his face. You know, we don't have to see how he's going to react here or anything like that at this particular point. You know, we can already imagine it ourselves.
Absolutely.
But we know that he now figures everything out. You know, and then you know, we hear the projectors continuing to whir, and then we get a shot of Winters as he's writing a letter by a lantern light. And, you know, we see Winter's face also, which is very somber as he's, you know, he's preparing himself for what he's about to go do. And he's about to lead, you know, into battle. And then we see that it's where he's walking around outside, looking around also, trying to just take it all in.
Well, and I think it's an important scene, too, because, you know, it's a mix of complicated emotions getting this extra day. Because, yeah, there is a sense of relief. I'm like, oh, well, we're gonna push that off a little bit. But then it gives you all that extra time to reflect. And it makes a lot of sense. Winters has this somber look on his face and contemplating these things and reflecting upon these things. And it gives you that extra space to really think about, oh, this is what I'm about to go do. And, you know, I think Damian Lewis sells that really well. And especially because if you're in a leadership role, it's not just your life that you're reflecting upon. It's like you have all of these men you're responsible for. And I think that contemplation that they show here is powerful moment for sure.
Yeah, I agree. The shot fades out again, and then we get a header on the screen saying June 5th, 1944, a Pottery airfield. So we now know it's the following day because, you know, their part of the attack will go out at the night of June 5th. And doesn't, you know, June 6th is the morning of the whole thing. And then we get a shot of the men now having to once again carry all of their equipment back from the tents onto the airfield. And we see predominantly in front. It's funny, most of the guys are all wearing helmets, and we see Winters without the helmet, you know, as he's walking across the field trying to get to where he needs to get to. And, you know, we see these men all carrying their various equipment that they need to. And as they're walking towards their planes, they pass a British anti-aircraft station getting ready to shoot, you know, if need be. And then one of the British soldiers that's standing there says, "Good luck, lads." And then Hoover turns to him and goes, "See ya, Tommy." And the soldier goes, "Give Jerry one for me." Now, I talked about this during Saving Private Ryan, that Tommy is a nickname for a British soldier. It's not that this is the guy's name.
Yep.
I mean, it could be.
He's Tommy the Tommy.
Could be. It could be that he's... exactly. It's very possible. but we do know that Jerry is the nickname for the German.
Yep.
So it's possible.
Like, they're going to be never know. Jerry the German and Tommy the Tommy.
That's right. And I just find it really funny that it's Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
You know, are they, you know, was there some sort of Looney Tunes connection here? Wait, like Tom and Jerry was... Tom and Jerry Looney Tunes? I don't even remember. I think it was.
I'm not sure if they're from, like, the same animators and stuff like that, but I know it is generally, like, it's Tom and Jerry's a little bit of a separate thing, because isn't Sylvester the cat, the Looney Tunes cat?
It was Hanna-Barbera.
There you go.
Sorry. Tom and Jerry were Hanna-Barbera.
Yep.
Right. Yes, Sylvester the cat was Looney Tunes with Tweety Bird. And the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote and Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd.
All the extra yeah. Media you're getting on this episode.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And you know, then the shot continues as you know, as the rest of the men walk by you know, this position. It's very interesting though, looking at it from the perspective that you know, you have these British anti-aircraft guys that this is their station, and they're watching these thousands of men go off to potential doom to go take care of this invasion. Yeah. You know, so, you know, and you see that there's an appreciation from them.
Well, you know, up to this point, it's like, it's very significant they're standing at these anti-aircraft guns, because it's like the war came to them. Mm-hmm. They had been staving off these German attacks on England up to this point, and now this big moment where they're finally pushing the war back to the main continent of Europe, and, you know, just having that little moment of connection between allies and showing that appreciation, because this was a big momentum shift in the war, was the United States getting involved.
Correct. We get a whole bunch of shots of the men getting ready, trying to figure out what they need to do here, and then we see them all helping each other with their gear on, and we hear someone say, "Try and get these leg straps through." You know, we see one of the guys has the Mae West on there. You know, this is not simple for them to be putting all this equipment on, mm-hmm. and getting it just right. So, you know, they do a nice job of showing the difficulty of, you know, all the things that we've been talking about how much gear they need to carry.
Yep.
And stuff like that.
Well, it's interesting that honestly, it kept reminding me, because, like, I remember reading the things they carry. Which is about Vietnam, but, you know, it's just that reinforcing of the physical toll of everything that soldiers carry into war. And then, you know, there's a lot of other things that they carry And all these moments, it's just like the this is that them putting all this on, putting all this together, trying to figure this out, just keep reinforcing that we are reaching the point where this is going to become real. And we're in that point of this episode where it's like we're almost there, where they actually get into war, and this is no longer training or anything like that.
100%. And then we get a shot of a whole bunch of the men standing next to one of the planes, helping each other with their gear. And then Garnier shows up and he screams, "Johnny!" And we see that that Martin was actually helping someone to put on his gear, and then someone else takes over for him. And then Martin walks over to Garnier, and Garnier goes, "That's something you might be looking for." He says, "Took your jacket by mistake." And he holds up the letter and he goes, "I'm sorry." He goes, "You read it?" And then he looks at him and goes, "Where the f Monte Cassino?" "I don't know. Italy somewhere." And he goes, "Sorry about your brother, Bill." And he goes, "I'm sorry for my ma. He was up." And he goes, "Let's get this over with." He goes, "Bill, I'll meet you up over there." So again, it shows the friendship between these two guys. And Garnier has to deal with his own demons right now, with the fact that that he had lost his brother recently. Again, according to the letter, it's pretty much been almost 2 months or a month and a half since that happened. So I like the way that they do that. That as far as we're concerned, this is it's new information for them, even though it's something that happened a while ago. But just because of the way that the mail comes through or doesn't come through, so that's why it took till now to actually get that information. Do you know anything about the Battle of Monte Cassino?
No.
Okay, so there were actually four battles that happened in Italy between January and May 1944,
Okay.
and that was referred to as the Battle of Monte Cassino. It was a brutal and costly campaign. In order for them to break the German line, and they were able to capture the strategically important town of Cassina, which was on the road to Rome. They actually ended up breaking through, and they were able to liberate Rome not long afterwards during the whole thing. Obviously, there's no way of knowing exactly when Garnier's brother died. We know according, I think when we were reading the letter, it said it was April 18th, so it means that it was sometime before that.
Yeah, obviously, in terms of just like the greater context of United States involvement, obviously we came up like Northern Africa through Sicily into Italy, and then coming back in through the UK and landing in France, because like that was a big momentum shift of pushing the war front back to France and into Germany. So I don't think I knew a whole lot of details specifically about Italy itself and the battles that were going on there, but I do understand like that basic pathway of the United States involvement at that part of the war.
So I mean, the only information I was able to get about about Henri Garnier is that he died in the Battle of Cassino.
Yep, there you go.
Doesn't give me anything beyond that, and that he died in 1944. That was the extent of the information that I got. He was a medic in the First Armored Division. That's all the information that I was able to find out about that. But again, I also like the way that they show the friendship between Garnier and Martin at this point.
Yeah. And there was that understanding of like, it could have, you could have added in extra layer of drama and being like, why didn't you tell me? Or all of that kind of stuff. But there's an understanding and kinship, and Martin reinforcing, it's like, I feel for you. And I thought it was very interesting that Grenier said, feel for my mom. And because you would think that she probably found out earlier, maybe, and she had been already dealing with this loss up to this point. And, he has to have his own approach to processing this, because he also has the very important thing that he has to get into the right mindset for. It was interesting seeing how he processed that.
The assumption is that Bill Gurney's mother found out a month and a half earlier.
Yeah.
You know, if Martin's wife was able to get the information from the newspaper or from wherever, so it was already a known thing at the time. Oh. You know, so. And then we get a very interesting shot, and we see all the men basically lying on the ground, looking as if they're from Wall-E, where they can't get up. I've fallen and I can't get up. And then we hear Meehan's voice saying, "Gentlemen, Dr. O is handing these out for air sickness. Orders are every man takes one now and another one 30 minutes in the air." And they're giving out air sick pills for them to, which is interesting that that's what they're giving out. And then Meehan turns to Winters, puts out his hand and goes, "Lieutenant." And then he shakes his hand. Again, it's a very small moment here, but it's a great moment showing the respect that these two men have for each other. You know, again, to go back to what I said before, we wouldn't have had a situation where Sobel would have acted this way. So it's a nice way to end this 5-minute segment. You know, Meehan wishing Winters good luck, basically.
Absolutely. And, you know, with the pills and everything, they certainly don't want the alternative to be going on sending all these.
I'm sure it happened.
I'm sure it did too. And I know obviously they're dealing with the air sickness, and then those landing on Normandy dealing with, like, you're in a giant metal box basically floating on the water and dealing with all the seasickness and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a thing. Pacific Rim showed us guys puking all over the place. Yeah,
it happened, and I'm sure there's others who reacted in different ways of, like, this impending thing about to happen. It's great. Acknowledging very human reactions to these big moments, but yeah, this is where that moment gets really real. It's like you're getting on this plane. So it's time to go.
Yep. And tomorrow we will continue to see what happens with the men that are here. So is there anything else you wanted to discuss about this, Shane?
I think just in summation, it's, you know, you have that moment of camaraderie between Garnier and Martin, which I think is impactful. And this just reinforcing them getting ready. And it's game time now. So
that's right. Most definitely. All right. Today's segment will be a trivia game. We will play World War II movie trivia. So, you know, once again, I'm going to spin the wheel and you're going to get questions about World War II movies. And we'll have to see
how I do.
You know, how well you know World War II movies.
Yep.
So you're going to get 5 of these.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get for your first question. In the movie The Sound of Music, what is Maria's occupation?
Her original one, she's a nun, but then she becomes a governess.
Right. Okay. I was referring to the nun aspect of it.
Okay.
But you're right. I mean, she was training to be a nun. She wasn't a nun yet.
Yep.
You know, that type of thing. All right.
That is excellent. Certainly one that I've watched many times, though.
Very good. All right. So let's spin the wheel and see what other questions you're going to get. And around and around and around the wheel goes. What film, based on a novel by James Joe, depicts a group of American soldiers during the Guadalcanal campaign?
I don't know if I know this one. I'm just going to throw out Guns of Navarone, one I haven't seen, so I don't even 100% know if that's about World War II or not.
Well, first of all, it is about World War II, but that's not what it is. Here, I'll give you a hint. This movie came out in 1998.
98? Is it The Thin Red Line?
Yes, it is. Very good.
You know, I watched that once and it's been so long ago, but I didn't distinctly remember exactly what what part of the war it was specifically about, but yeah.
Okay. I got to rewatch it because I've never been a fan of it, but you know, something that I keep telling myself I got to rewatch.
It's an interesting approach, Terrence Malick taking on a war film for sure.
Yes. Correct. All right. Let's spin the wheel again for your third question. What 1950 movie deals with a bunch of POWs trying to escape from a POW camp?
Trying to remember. I don't think The Great Escape was that early in the 50s.
No, The Great Escape was 1963.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I'm like, wait a minute.
The truth is, but it takes place in the exact same, the same camp.
Oh,
the same camp that they escaped from The Great Escape. This is also based on a true story.
Interesting. I don't know if I know this one thing, because that's exactly where my head went. I'm like, but The Great Escape wasn't that early on in terms of film. And I'm trying to think of, oh, I have an idea of what this might be. And I'm trying to remember what the title of it might be. But I don't think I'm going to get this one.
Well, what do you remember about what it might be? Let's put it that way, because the title is what they use in order to escape.
I'm not 100%. Is it about tunneling, similar to like The Great Escape?
Well, there is tunneling, but okay. The name of the movie is The Wooden Horse.
Okay. I haven't seen that one.
Okay, and they use like a pommel horse.
Interesting.
To cover up the fact they're digging underneath.
You know, film that to my watch list.
Okay, it's a pretty good movie, especially. Mm. When you think of it from the perspective of The Great Escape.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have watched that one.
It's not amazing. It's good.
Countless times. So that's like immediately where my head went. So.
Okay. Fair enough. But it did happen in Stalag Luft 3. So
interesting. That makes
sense. All right. So let's spin the wheel again and see where we go. Around and around and around for the fourth question for Shane. Okay, which 1949 John Wayne movie follows the training of U.S. recruits who are tasked with capturing a strategic Pacific island?
So in the Pacific, we were Expendable Wars a few years before that, because I'm pretty sure that came out like right at the beginning. Right, like that was coming out during the war or right at the end of the war. I'm going to throw out a title, Last Goodbye, something like that.
Okay, the hint is going to be that the name of the island that they need to attack is in the title of the movie.
Is it Sanzu Iwo Jima?
Yes,
there you go.
Excellent. Nicely done. All right, and now for your final question, let's spin the wheel and see what we get. And around and around and around and around we go. Okay, in the movie from 1956, The Man Who Never Was, what is The Man Who Never Was?
I haven't seen this one. I'm going to guess Prisoner of War?
No. The answer is a cadaver.
Oh. There you go. See, that makes even more sense.
In order to confuse the Germans, they dress up a cadaver in an officer's uniform, attach fake plans to, you know, to a briefcase that he's carrying, and the Germans believe that that the Allies are going to attack somewhere else.
There you go, the smart plan. So didn't do great,
and it's based on truth. It's based on a true story, also.
There you go. Well, it didn't do great, but with a little help, I got a couple of them. So there you go.
Okay, that's fair. Fair enough. So now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie.
Sounds good.
So once again, we will spin the wheel and see what we get. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Okay, this is a movie from 1959 starring Cary Grant. About a very strange submarine.
I don't think I've seen any war films with Cary Grant in it. So I don't know if I've seen this one, but A Strange Submarine.
Or I'll even change it. A strange colored submarine.
Interesting. I'm gonna feel like I should at least throw out some name of the movie. At least give it a chance. So, trying to think.
It also stars Tony Curtis
Sounds like a
and
good cast. It sounds worth checking out.
it has an it's direct it was directed by Blake Edwards.
I have a sinking feeling I'm going to kick myself when you say the name of this movie because I feel like I might know the name of the movie, but I can't figure it out at the
Right.
moment.
It also stars Dick Sargent, from Bewitched, Gavin McLeod from The Love Boat, Marion Ross from Happy Days.
It, I got nothing. I'm not pulling anything.
All right, it's called Operation Petticoat.
See, I did know the name of that movie, and I knew that I was gonna, because like, it's funny because there's some World War II films that I absolutely love. I'm not gonna say that I'm the most well-versed in watching World War II films, but I know enough names of them where I was mad at myself through the trivia in this, where I'm like, I know just enough to feel like I have a chance here. But it, I have heard of that film before, and so at the end of the day, didn't get it right. So there you go.
That's okay. You'll have another chance tomorrow.
I sure will.
In,
We'll see
unless
if we get that one.
unless you, unless you don't want to do that again. Unless you've had enough.
Well, I enjoy, like, I used to do actually academic challenge. Like, I did knowledgeable trivia in high school. And I've won a couple of movie trivia contests at my college when I was a student. So, this is just a very specific genre that I know an all right amount for, but I still find it fun. So, we'll try again tomorrow.
Okay.
So,
Great. All right. So, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Shane content?
yes. So if you follow me, The Wasteland Reviewer on Instagram, I shamelessly plug everything I do. Some of the key places, I am primarily a YouTuber. The Wasteland Reviewer YouTube channel. Review tons of films and have 3 weekly shows. I also have my website, thewastelandreviewer.blog, where I have written reviews and weekly and monthly articles. Do some writing for SiftPop.com and KnockOnWoodFilms.com. And I'm a podcaster with the SPM Crew Podcasting Network, dabbling into trying out Substack and such. But I have my link tree on my Instagram page where I try to keep everything that I do there. So check it out.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. It's a shame you feel like coming back in tomorrow for one more 5 minute segment.
Well, I'm ready to go.
All right, excellent. So until tomorrow, Curhee!
Hurry!